Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson, and sadly there is no Maureen. We've actually, it's a really funny story. We triple booked somehow. In all of my life, I've never triple booked, but that happened. Maureen is at a production meeting for Hearing in Color. So if you haven't checked out that event, do that. And then there was also another group that we'll be recording with. That'll be the next episode, Bad Witches Club, that was here. But they are going to come back because they're great people. But I am so glad to be here with some folks from the ever illustrious and immortal Nothing Without a Company. I am joined by Hannah Herrera Greenspan and Ryan Oliveira and Anna Rose E.E. Epstein. And can we just celebrate for a moment that I got through that without Maureen? It's like, not that you have beautiful names. And like, I felt so nervous. And the other thing is like, so I lived in Florida for like, because we were mentioning before, you were like, oh, should I pronounce it? Like, I like took 6 years of Spanish, but like fucking butchered it just because I was so nervous.
Me
like,
too. I took 6 years and butchered it.
Lived in
well.
Florida for 17 years. People still butcher the crap out of my name. So,
yeah, I'm from SoCal.
Spanish speakers. It's a world. Good language. Like, and the language makes so much sense. Like, yeah, what is the boy doing? Sorry, Oscar's being some sort of way.
Noises.
But thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
How are you all doing today?
It's a cold one.
It's in the negatives.
Yeah. That, I think that was like the most, because I was definitely this afternoon at like 4 o'clock, I was like, I can't leave this bed right now. Like, I need to just kind of like...
I actually left the bed pretty early for me, and I went all the way to Columbia, and I was like, I'm out, I'm in it, this ain't too bad, let's do this. My nose hair was definitely frozen.
Yep.
Nostril icicles.
That's to be expected with negative degrees, so.
Was not expecting the snow, though, today.
Oh, but I love it.
But that's just a primer for Sunday, when we get these 6 to 10 inches from Sunday, late Sunday into Monday. And that's your weather forecast with Ryan Oliveira.
Can we take one sec? All right, welcome back. Thank you so much. Sorry about that. Yeah, no, I easily overwhelmed. I have no idea if that's like a SAG thing. We were talking about astrology before we started. But like, as soon as you get too many like things in the frying pan for me, I'm like, let's just throw a mic out there and see if it works. And then I was like, wait a minute. I can't hear Anna that well. So welcome back, Anna. Sorry
Thank you.
About that.
Yes, I'm all about juggling. So just if you need to multitask, just hold my hand.
Yeah.
And I'll help you out.
Well, speaking of that that quite illustrious experience that you have with that, there is another project that do you have a running count how many times we've had Nothing Without a Company on?
No. More than 5, maybe? Always me, though. And I actually wasn't planning on coming on today. I want you to talk to Ryan and Hannah a lot. But since Maureen is here, I'm just pretending like I'm her today.
Little fill-in. No, that's great. Well, then let's absolutely jump in. So the project that is upcoming, can you contextualize a little bit about it for our audience? A little intro?
Yeah. So the project that... Nothing Without a Company is producing, which is opening on February 14th on Valentine's Day, is a play called Soccer Player in the Closet. It's a play that I wrote. That is, I like to call it like one part ghost story, one part family drama, one part something about toxic masculinity, one part about, you know, queer relationships, and all parts incredibly kooky and weird. but essentially about sort of the difficulty of moving on. And the difficulty of sort of confronting failure when you are queer and you are also a Latinx person. And usually a son or daughter or child of Latinx immigrants. And sort of the confrontation we have to sort of deal with that. So it's kind of a play that tries to encompass all of that with the really fun, thrilling issue of esports, particularly FIFA, if you play.
Cool. Interesting. Well, because, like, esports is something that... So I've, like, kind of been getting into computer building, if anybody... I've probably mentioned this on the show. And esports is very... Like, the whole world of it is so interesting.
Oh, my God.
But I actually wasn't aware of the layer up. There are so many layers to this. But, like, the esports is interesting because, like, the it's interesting that it's FIFA, which, because the esports world is
that
there,
confused
is there a big,
me so much.
Is there a big sports video games genre in esports? I mean, there must be, right? Because there's so many.
Yeah. I mean, they're mostly like League of Legends, things like League of Legends, sort of like the fantastical sort of battling of Warcraft or StarCraft or something like that. But there is a sizable portion where it's, you know, it's FIFA or Madden or NBA, where, you know, it's like you take the physical sports and model them into the soccer, model them into the video game world, and then sort of craft teams or craft solo performers who basically, you know, compete for thousands upon thousands
of dollars. It's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that's also really interesting too is that you have a lot of cases where you have like a genre player that'll play like games of a category.
Yep.
Is that like sports across the board usually, or do FIFA players usually stick to FIFA? Do you know?
I don't actually. That is the one thing I don't. I would imagine that particularly for esports, you tend to pretty much remain relatively the same, or at least like
cobble together. You stay in your lane,
or you stay in like, yeah, I'm pretty good with, you know. I would imagine you would stay in your lane, unless you're, you know, the kind of person who's just like, I do really like, you know, Overwatch, and I like playing, you know, FIFA, and there's just two aspects of your brain that cross-pollinate. But I'm pretty sure from a production esports standpoint, you would probably stay in your lane. And if not, I will be called out on that, and that is perfectly fine.
Y'all are speaking in a foreign language to me still. Honestly, I don't understand the gaming world.
Which this show also has, is also trilingual.
Well, so, yeah. So this is where what I love about what Nothing But a Company does is how much perspective-driven work it is. And I love the degree to which there's letting the balance of those perspectives be done by the people that live that experience. Mm-hmm. And you've already spoken to that a bit when you were talking about it, but I want to know more. And the thing that I always am curious about, and I'm curious if you can verbalize, is what the experience is when it comes to, especially as a writer, especially when it comes to crafting a narrative, how to balance all of these things. Because does a lot of this come from, like, how much of the play comes from your own lived experience? How much are you willing to say it does, and all of that, of course, but like, and how does that, all of that balancing, because is it a thing that you lately, I've been finding myself verbalizing it as, like, do you find yourself analyzing or just doing more?
You know, Ryan, I think it might be helpful is, like, if you explain where the play stems from.
Oh my god.
Just because,
god,
like,
yes.
Like, literally, so can I share, like, all of our dramaturgy? Okay, do so it. All of our do meetings it. Have happened at Nando's. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Nando's.
Great chicken.
That chicken place.
Well, so I'm vegan, but I'm very familiar with it because of the cult. Like, it's like, also, like, just.
And halloumi.
And they have a lot of great vegetarian options.
Like, I also really. Vegan options, I think. Enjoy understanding spices. Like, that's fun. Anyway, sorry, I cut you off.
No, it's okay. So, all of our meetings have happened at Nando's, and, like, the first meeting that we ever had, I asked Ryan, like, hey, just, like, tell me, where did this play stem from? Like, why did you write this now? And I typically like to ask, like, all of the writers I work with that, like, why are you writing this play now, as opposed to 5 years ago, and as opposed to 5 months from now? Like, why now? And Ryan had a very extensive list that he shared, and a really great story, so I don't know if you feel comfortable with...
I feel comfortable anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
All the hard questions.
All the core questions.
That's why we love you, Ryan.
Well, it's because I'm also a solo performer, so I'm like, literally, like, making myself vulnerable on stage while also doing that in my writing, so it's not a problem. So I wrote this play about 6 months after I graduated from grad school in 2015 from the University of Iowa, and several things happened. One, I came out to my mom. Did not go very well. Two, I went to Brazil for the first time in 13 years to visit family, where I'm now having to visit them as an out gay man, but still having to be closeted because they're really conservative. And then I came back to the States and had my tonsils removed, and then had complications, which means I had to stay in bed for an entire month living with a room full of 7 cats. Which managed to get my allergy. So I had a lot of time to think about it. And then in the entire... Oh, and then apparently I was hanging out with my brother, who would get high all the time and play FIFA. And then watching the sexual innuendo happen, it's like, I shouldn't be listening to this, but let me lean in. So I had to sort of take all of this, and I guess it was, you know, I had just moved to Chicago after my, you know, respite in Iowa where I was not talking. And I was just so incredibly depressed. I was depressed because my last year of grad school went absolutely horribly. I didn't think I was like doing anything good as a writer. I had failed my parents. I had failed, I'd failed my own culture in several ways. Like, I was supposed to be a doctor and now I'm a writer and I'm not doing anything. And I just kind of sat and like laid in bed for the first month when I moved in Chicago. I was like not doing anything. And I was watching a lot of Dr. G Medical Examiner on YouTube because they had a few episodes out. And one of the episodes was about a man who had laid in bed for approximately like about a month. And the sister finds him in bed and they're like, what could have possibly happened to him? So we, so Dr. G, who's an
autopsy. And the sister found him dead, right?
Yeah, I think sister found him dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Dr.
The, what happened to him came in.
So Dr. G, who is a mortician, basically does the physical examination, can't find anything wrong with him until she cuts open his belly and there is this incredibly putrid smell from him. And they're like, oh my God, what could have possibly happened? Well, the only kinds of patients who have this rotten smell out of them either like have HIV or have had cancer. Turns out he had none of them. Turns out he died of basically a football-sized poo that had perforated his colon. Spoiler, like, trigger alert for anybody listening. This is pretty visceral. And, he had just been broken up with, like, had been divorced by his wife, lost all of his kids, and basically just laid in bed for an entire month.
Never, not getting up.
Not getting up at all. So basically his metabolism slowed to a standstill and basically just blocked up his colon. And I thought, A, what a horrible way to die.
Yeah. Incredibly painful.
And incredibly painful. And B, Jesus, I've been doing that. Lord knows what, like, whoa. So I had to A, get up and walk around Lake Michigan for a bit.
Yeah.
And then from there, I just started writing this play about this soccer player, this former esports soccer player. He's like lost his job, lost everything. And he's stuck in bed, and people have to sort of piece together what happens with him. What could have possibly done that? And that was, like, that was 2015. And then I sent it to a bunch of places, and nobody picked it up. And I was like, okay, cool. And then come 2018, when Kevin approached me, I think. And who is, and they're the literary manager for Nothing Without a Company. They found this, my play on New Play Exchange, and they're like, gave me some notes. I was like, wow, I have to actually reconcile, like, after years of therapy and several breakups, I have to now go back into this play and reconcile about why it was so important. And I kept thinking about Pulse, and I kept thinking about, you know, the things that we don't talk about. Particularly, like, so I'm a Brazilian-American, so we don't talk, like, depression was not a thing we talked about in my family. The idea of being the son of immigrants, I was either supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer or get the hell out of my house. And, luckily, I got the hell out of the house and, you know, became a playwright, but there's still that tension with my parents. And there's all this incredible amount of what is expected to be when you are the son, or when you are a man of immigrants, all these promises that you are supposed to be for people, mm-hmm. and you fail at them, and, you know, and yet you have no place to talk to, and no one to really be there. What, we're all kind of failing to some degree, and how do we navigate that experience? And it, even now, you know, I wrote it in 2015, not a damn thing's changed. just because we're now starting to having to talk about masculinity and how certain aspects of masculinity are incredibly toxic to us. And, you know, the fact that we can't talk about our emotions or our feelings, or we have to talk about, you know, that masculinity is a process of possession. And it's like, we need to change that narrative. And I have to even change that narrative for myself. So it is evolved, that play has evolved from a lot of me, a lot of basically being like, this is my depression play about me staying in bed and not ending up like the guy from Dr. G Medical Examiner, to kind of a disseminated sense of self, where it's like, we are like, I almost feel like a lot of these characters are like aspects of myself that are failing in different ways. And these, they're all having to intertwine and navigate each other and fight each other to some extent, to really assert that A, that they're enough, and B, that they can survive with each other, which is the hippy dippy way of saying this is what the play has evolved into, the thing that hopefully audiences get, I would love audiences to go get to see in February and either prove me wrong or at least to have a conversation about that.
And Hannah was working with Ryan before NWAC kind of got involved. I'm curious, actually, how y'all found each other as a dramaturg.
I've talked enough, Hannah. Writer. You tell me.
How did we find each other?
Because you're a professional dramaturg.
I am a professional dramaturg. Yes. Nancy. So we have a mutual friend, Nancy Garcia-Losa, who's amazing. Also a brilliant playwright. She's just been featured in the New York Times. And
for
she's
her
also
play, Brava at 16th Street.
And you can also listen to it, too. It's a podcast as
it's
well.
It's a podcast that's play.
It's a corrido, which is a traditional Mexican way of storytelling.
Can you link that in here?
I should absolutely do that, yes.
If you have some spare time, absolutely listen to it. So, it's
love
so
that
so good.
That's
so
such a cool concept.
Nancy was having this like workshop of one of her other brilliant plays, and she was like, "Oh, I want to invite like a small group of people that I like and who I trust to like help me figure out like what this play is and where it needs to go." And Ryan was there and facilitating the reading of the play.
So it was
Iowa style.
Yeah. So at the university, I went to the grad school at the University of Iowa. So we do a variation of feedback where you listen to the entire full-length play, no matter how long it is. You take like 5 minutes for your pee break. Mm-hmm. And then you come back, and basically for the next hour, you basically talk about everything that you were curious about, everything that insights, pops, and you
questions
playwrights had, particularly around the text. And then basically it's just an open discussion, and it can take as long as it can, and it's really intense because technically you cannot say you value anything in the script. So you cannot like and you cannot love anything, and you cannot say this is wrong. You cannot be prescriptive. You can't be anything. You just...
It's so hard.
It's super... I even had a hard time, and yeah, I'm the moderator.
I was hard... You pushed me to. You're like, just say it. And I was like, oh, okay, I have to break the fucking rules here. I have to say, okay, I really like this part because it reminded me of my childhood in this specific way.
And it's so good for nascent like plays that are just like germinating, because like nothing is sacred and nothing is safe. The text is all you have. You have this whole totality. So you have to like talk about themes and patterns and just really take all of it. So for a first time playwright, I'm staring at a tsunami. It's going to hit me in the face right now.
Yeah. But the people that she had in the room, I think, made it work, and it was super welcoming. And I think that's what made her not feel that whole like tsunami image of like, oh my God, what is this play? What I don't even know what it is anymore. I'm going to put it in a drawer and not think about it. And then after that, we went out to karaoke, coincidentally enough, and then Ryan sang Selena, and I was like, oh, maybe we should, like, be friends and, like, work together.
Luckily, she accepted my friend request. Good Lord knows.
And we exchanged business cards. We were like, oh, you also got them from this website, too.
Yeah, so, Moo, yeah. It's Moo, amazing.
I love Moo. Moo's I also best. Use Moo. Moo's great, yeah. I'm so sorry. The thing that I was going to ask was... the thing that I find really interesting is hearing you talking about this kind of workshop space, because it's something that I think is really relatable when you're working on something conceptually, especially as a writer, especially as an artist, of like, it can be very fruitful to try and as hard as you can to bring something to an objective space. Mm-hmm. I think about this a ton with journalism. Because you do that thing where you are writing about something and you just so much want to be like, this is dumb. Like, this is why this is dumb. This is great. This is why this is great. But you can't, like, you can't do that because the point of, like, if you are a person or a writer or a publication that wants to prioritize objective journalism, you do that because you just want to tell the story, you want to make progress, and for whatever reason. But that kind of, like, will versus feelings, maybe, thing that you were talking about of, like, wanting to say, I liked this or I love this, versus knowing that you need to, like, dilute that into a academic friendly space, maybe, if that's what, like, that I want to kind of talk or ask more about that balance when it came to this work. Like, can you verbalize what those factors were with this work, as far as, like, what do you think this work gained from having that kind of academic lens?
Oh.
Well, I have to say that Ryan has been really great to work with because he's like a writer that actually is open to feedback, and a lot of writers, especially new ones, they are really connected to their words, every single one, and want to see it that way or nothing at else. And Hannah,
hate those writers.
Well, they're just still new. And Hannah and Ryan have a great process too. At the very start, they were like, you know, we should really be like, if there is any feedback, we should give it to Hannah, and then Hannah can give it to Ryan. And so that's been really great.
Yeah, and Ryan, I must say, I want to strongly co-sign on that as well. Just because, like, no, seriously, like,
you're
also the kind of writer too that's like, whenever somebody gives you a note, like, let's change it, I'm like, Ryan, pause. I'm like, I want you to sit in this note for a minute. Yeah. And he also did, might I add, two huge rewrites, one over Christmas, and then the next one on New Year's Day or New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve.
And I'm like, and then we're at the first rehearsal literally a week later, and he's like, I want a new draft. And I'm like, I want you to not touch this play, not even a minute cut, anything at all, for at least a week and a half. I'm like, that's
that rule so
he
hard.
Did. I was like, what did I tell you?
But for the good of the work.
I know you did, but
I know
you did two huge rewrites, and then wrote the play twice.
But that's like,
and then recently you did some a big change too, which I think is. I actually broke the rule of talking to you about it first. Sorry, we were in the car talking.
But it's okay. I talked to Hannah about it. And she's like, good. Let me just, like popcorn this off you and see what you think. And okay. I actually, watching a rehearsal, it was really beautiful to watch. It's like, oh, this makes sense now. But yeah, I think for me, going through that academic rigor, it taught me that nothing was sacred. And I think as a writer, it's really, really important to, and I'm considered incredibly over-humble just by, like, my boyfriend basically kills me on it every single time. It's just like, you need to be prouder of yourself. It's like, no, because nothing is proud yet. But it just really taught me that because ultimately, like, I don't own these words. The actors are going to have to own these words. And however it's going to, situationally, performatively, it's going to operate is up to them. And if I don't, and for me, I'm actually a little bit more musically inclined. So when it comes to editing, I take a good hard look at cadence and rhythm. And if it's just not landing right, it's just like, okay, well, the problem is usually for me is like, it's usually with me. And I usually can't quite do that. It's really helpful to have Hannah in the room, and I've said this to you drunk, but I'm going to say this to you sober.
Oh, great.
No, you were incredibly instrumental. You've been incredibly instrumental in the success and the progress of this work, because you've added an objective lens where I as a writer cannot see the forest for the trees. And Hannah's just like, no, but let's unpeel this. Let's really take a look at, you know, what you're trying to accomplish and see if this is, I mean, when we were revising the prologue, I was just like, she really pinned it on me and was like, what do you want the audience to walk away with? What do you really want them to think about this moment? And eventually we kind of figured out it was just like this almost like this minutiae of like the way the verbiage was going. And then we finally made sense of it. And that would have not been possible without you, because I'm like Aquarius brain. It's all in my head. I can come up with a bajillion ideas, but she grounds me. Mm-hmm. And like, this sounds like we're in a relationship.
Yeah, this is a love fest. I know, it totally does. But I agree, Ryan. Like, Hannah, you've been so great. And like, you've done more than I've ever seen a dramaturg
do. But that's the power of playwright-dramaturg relationships. Mm-hmm. Like, dramaturgs...
Yeah. That's why new playwrights absolutely need dramaturgs. It's absolutely necessary. Like, you can't write a new play without one.
And I hardly ever had a dramaturg when I was in grad school, like, except for Sarah Johnson, who's amazing and an amazing gamer, who's now in Texas with her little boy. She's great. For me, I like to work with playwrights and even directors who ground me, because I'm always full of ideas and someone needs to say, like, Ryan, sit the frick down and just, like, think about it. Just sit and let us do the work. If it doesn't work, after three times, we'll try it. Like, mm-hmm. we'll come back to you. Or to be just, you know, because I can come up with solutions all the time. And it's just because I'm really, really uncomfortable mm-hmm. with how anything is. So it's always nice to have someone to dialogue it out mm-hmm. and not feel like it's all resting in my own brain, which therapeutically and psychologically, worst place to ever be in. So yeah. So that's why, for me, it's essential to have Hannah in the room and Hannah in the process. And as a playwright-dramaturg relationship, I mean, like, I'm an Aquarius, she's Leo. It works out. It's a good working relationship.
I want to piggyback on this, and I want to, because we have had the chance to talk about, like, dramaturgy conceptually and the importance of it on the podcast, but I want to hammer it in for any audience members that, like, have not gotten that yet.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you'd be willing to kind of talk more about just, like, contextually the role of a dramaturg, but then also talk about how those pieces have come into play during this process.
Yeah. Educate them children.
I will. So dramaturgy is like an interesting thing that I think a lot of people think that they know, but then they're like, oh yeah, you're like a walking encyclopedia, right?
Right.
I'm like, no, mm-hmm. not that kind of a dramaturg. I mean, I'm not shaming those kinds, but for me, I think dramaturgy, particularly new play dramaturgy, is a super collaborative act. So yes, I put together research for the actors, for the production team, for just basically any information that you'd need to know to do this play. But for me, it's all, again, it's collaborative. So anytime one of the actors is like, hey, I have a question about like this thing, I'm like, oh, you're right, I should do some more investigating in this thing. So that's really what it comes down to for me, is it's super collaborative and all hands on deck. It's not like, oh, I'm the keeper of all of the secrets and I'm the smartest person in the room. That's the way that I was taught how to do dramaturgy. And it is extremely old school, and I don't think it really works. And I think you have to throw that textbook out and just...
This is a thing I think about a lot, because I think about a lot what it's like to come from like a rural background, or from basically not living in a city, or not having intense academic experience of that, but then coming from that and then also having to be in a intensely academic yeah. experience where you have to kind of be both things. And not to say that, like, I'm not equating the rehearsal room with what it is to be rural in a rural experience, but what I more mean is the ability to communicate immediately while also having the ability to do intense research.
You do, and like, you have to know, like, you have to pick your battles, where it's like, there's some moments in the room and like, there's some notes that like, that are in my brain that Ryan doesn't even know. Mm-hmm. Because I'm like, oh, in this moment, Ryan seems a little overwhelmed because of like something that's being staged right now. So I'm going to just keep my mouth shut and save it for another day. Mm-hmm. And then there's other times where I'm like, oh, this is immediate and like, this is happening right now, and if I don't say anything now, it'll never change. Mm-hmm. So then I'm like, actually, we need to fix this line, and here's why. Mm-hmm. Or I'm like, how do you think this is working? I'm like, don't you think there's like a faster way of getting to this point a little better? And Ryan's like, oh yeah, there is. And that's just really what it comes down to. And I think, for me at least, new play dramaturgy is just about being the best play reader and being an pure intuition, really, and just knowing and really hashing out, like Ryan said, about talking things out and just knowing, what is this play, what is it, what do we want to do with it, what is the impact that we want to have on it, and just remembering that and being like, hey, remember this thing we said 3 months ago, where is that in the script?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I mean, I also double as a dramaturg. I'm not nearly as good as she is. Full disclosure. Totally unbiased opinion. But for me, it's like a crucial part of dramaturgy is meeting the play where it's at and seeing where the play can go and understanding what the seeds and the themes and patterns. I mean, the way I was taught dramaturgy, I wasn't taught dramaturgy until grad school, which is so late in the game.
Yeah, I'm a fairly young dramaturg. Yeah. Like, I figured out I wanted to be a dramaturg when I was 17. Mm-hmm. Like...
Oh my god, yeah. Who thinks of... I was just, like, on the way, just like, who thinks of themselves as a dramaturg at 17?
I did. Like, I was... It was truly,
that
like...
That was DePaul students.
No, it was actually high school where I figured it out. But yes, DePaul. But it honestly was, like, truly a Harry Potter story. Like, I went to a performing arts high school, which was really nice, and I took a directing class. Not many people can say that they took a directing class in high school and read, like, all the directing theories, like Michael Shortlift and, you know, all the seven guideposts.
Michael Shortlift is.
Okay, well, anyway. So...
someone does.
Someone out there listening.
This dramaturg does.
Yeah.
So I was, like, you know, we had to, like, direct a scene, and we did a bunch of dramaturgical research. Didn't know that that's what it was called at the time. And when it came down to actually, like, directing the scene, I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea, like, where to tell these actors where to move. So I went to my teacher. I'm like, you know, I'm stuck. I think I need to go back into the play, do some more research, like, do some more digging about, like, why this playwright wrote this play, like, when they did, and, like, the history behind it. And he just started laughing, was like, you're not a director, you're a dramaturg. And I'm like, what did you just call me? Like, I thought he just called me something, like, really horrible. And he's like, no, it's a thing, trust me. And he explained it to me. And he, like, handed me this book called What is Dramaturgy? And I was like, and I read about it, and I read it, and I was like, oh, that's me. And then I figured out, oh, I can study this and do this for a living. And here we are.
I mean, and for me, like, dramaturgy, like, I remember in grad school, because we had to take all the, like, we had to take, like, theater, like theater structure courses, like, all the, so I'm like, the dramaturg who's, like, into really weird structures for plays. So for me, I, like, people will come to me, it's like, I don't know how to do the structure. It's like, well, have you thought, like, here are the patterns that I'm seeing, and here's the motifs. Here's what, like, keeps dredging up. What if you build these images up into a pattern that you, it's like audience-centric dramaturgy. It's like, how are you teaching your audience how to watch your show? Mm-hmm. I can't even do that to my own plays, because it sucks. It's like... Like, playwrights are horrible dramaturgs for their own work.
Oh, yeah.
Another eye, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is why, so usually for when I'm usually dramaturging other people's works, I like to think about themes and images that come up and transitional work, and then think about, like, well, how are you structuring this story? Are you structuring the story in a way, like, is this almost like a classic ghost story, or is it like, are you doing this in a filmic sort of mm-hmm. way where you're trying to get different perspectives and trying to piece the puzzle together, or is it like, does it work just to put them out of time because you're creating something completely different in the disjointed narrative that you're kind of, and you're having to think about that, which is so Aquarius.
And I think also, like, getting back to dramaturgy in terms of this process, and, like, because this play, Soccer Player, is so multi-layered, and this beautiful world that you've crafted, Ryan, like, for me, my job mostly was, for me, like, my job mainly was, like, okay, how are all of these different layers getting into the final, like, how are all these, like, different layers of the cake getting pieced together? Mm-hmm. And, like, what's the glue for each of them, really, is what was kind of, like, my North Star in the rehearsal room and just in general for this play.
She's like my Paul Hollywood in the British Bake Off.
Hell yeah. I want to double back. I want to touch more on this. The thing that I think is another piece that is... One thing that we talk about... Well, let me get to the piece. One thing that I think that we talk a lot about on the podcast is... We ask a lot about, what does Chicago mean to your work? And we can talk about that if you want to. But the main thing I also really want to think about is, like... Place is really interesting, and it's something that I want to explore more, and is really relevant, I think, to this play, especially considering Brazil is such a, like, geopolitically, it's so interesting. Like, when you, like, if you take South America just alone and look at Brazil's relationship to South America, it's so fascinating.
Nobody wants it.
I'm kidding. But I think the other piece that's really interesting with a work like this is, I'm curious, you know, with everything that is Brazil, what has it brought to the room, and what has it brought to the play, and what would you basically, are there things that positive or negative would not be the way that they are if it were any other country that was the kind of the foundation identity wise?
Yeah, I think it's because of Brazil's notoriety with soccer in particular. Mm-hmm. It's probably the chief thing. I mean, I'm going to say right now, I'm totally biased, and I completely get it. Brazil is one of the best soccer teams in the world. Yeah, they might have been routed by Germany that one time in the World Cup at 7-1, but yeah, they didn't play like good team day owners. But generally speaking, they have dominated the landscape. The idea of Brazil plays like no one else.
And also just soccer, just rooted in the culture.
It's completely rooted in the culture. It's a dance. It's a jogo bonito. It's a...
The beautiful game.
The idea that it's this life force that permeates everything we do. The idea that the language is just... It's a different cadence and rhythm than it is to Spanish and Portuguese, which is super European. Mm. The idea that Brazil's relationship to the United States in terms of immigration is fairly different. I remember growing up and being like, you know, like Brazilian agents would give me a really hard time because of my American passport, or wouldn't let any of my relatives come to the United States for fear they were going to like basically jump ship. So they had to go around the other way, because that's the experience that Brazil had with the U.S. where it's like, you got relatives in Brazil? You shouldn't be going to Brazil at all. You shouldn't be going to the U.S. at all. What's wrong with you? So we had to, literally happen, we had to, like, one of my relatives had to lie that she didn't have relatives in the States in order for her to, like, come into the United States to essentially work. She ended up going back to Brazil, but for reasons that we will not detail on this podcast, but it's got that weird, like, weirdo vibe to it. The fact that Brazil is actually quite close to the U.S. when you look at its like political hammerings, even though it's been a democracy for like 30 some odd years. Mm-hmm. Politically and even culturally, even racially to a certain extent, we forget that Brazil had a huge slavery culture. Huge. Mm-hmm. Just like the United States. Probably more so. And still has like an incredibly difficult time to talk about race. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly segregated in Brazil, and it's, you know, the idea of colorism and exoticism,
and then the race relations just in and of itself.
The fact that like to Americans, generally, if you're a Brazilian, you're either like a super hot model or a maid, of which I am neither. So for me, it was even bigger for me to like provide an experience where it's just like, yes, this is about a Brazilian American, like about a Brazilian American, actually two, well, one's a Brazilian American, but both who are Brazilians who are not your typical Brazilians at this point. And I wanted to posit that out into the world so you didn't have to come in and be like, wait, where's the Brazilian stripper? Nowhere in this play, people. So yeah.
It's fascinating, the piece, the Brazil aspect, because, you know, when you're producing in America, like anytime that you get outside, like you go to any perspective, so many like American audiences will paint with a wide brush.
Good Lord, yeah.
But there is, so with Brazil specifically, there's so many details to paint, like when it comes to character and to narrative and things like that. And I have a thought coming and I'm sensing it not turning into a question, so I'm just kind of like readdressing what I'm saying.
Well, I got something. The thing that, because I'm, you know, I'm a producer, I run the company, so the things that I was really excited about the show, especially right after doing Not One Bot Two, which is a completely different language than American English, is that the show has Spanish and Portuguese in it. Mm-hmm. Which not to the point where like people won't understand what's going on, but it's really cool to have different languages in shows, I think. Mm-hmm. And then you know, the queer thing as, yes, well.
Well, it's just a different rhythm. It's a different rhythm.
And even like, yeah, sorry to cut you off, but like when we first started talking about this, I was like, oh, how refreshing is it to hear and like read Portuguese in a play?
Right.
I mean, that never happens. I mean, like now, like you're starting to see a lot more plays being produced with Spanish in them, which I'm all for, but like that's now starting to become like in the mainstream, which is nice, but at the same time, but it's particularly like Mexican Spanish, like not like other kinds of Spanish, but it's a different conversation. But like particularly
for don't tell this to the people in New York. They'll hurt you for that.
I know they will hurt me for that. But like just having again Portuguese just in this is I think a radical act in and of itself.
I wanted to thank you for that, because that so I do want to make sure I actually do that, which is to thank you for that, because it is, I think it's very easy to assume that Portuguese and Spanish are more similar than not, but they're not.
They're so different.
The poor actors in our show who have to learn for a zillion Portuguese.
Well, here's
we don't have a dialect coach either, which is they're doing great for
they're doing amazing work considering we've got like 4 weeks where it's like you gotta hammer this down and which we have a little bit, at least the beautiful thing about this is particularly at least with Cristiano, there's a little bit of leeway in like Portuguese fluency, but yeah, it's a Herculean feat, and like
they're not the same thing.
They're not, and that's the hard thing, because they will so if you're a Spanish speaker, you'll instantly like lapse into Portuguese. Or, like, lapse into Spanish if you're speaking Portuguese. Just like I would do if I were speaking Spanish to someone. It's like, I don't quite know
what it is. You slip back into Portuguese. Like, I work for a Brazilian company as, like, my day job. And I hear Portuguese. Like, half of the office is actually from Brazil. And the other half is from the States. And, like, I'm hearing Portuguese, like, all the time. I've been there for, like, 4 months. Still can't pick up the Portuguese. Mm-hmm. Like.
But you speak Spanish.
I do speak Spanish. Yeah, like, I mean, there's, like, some more. Like, I can pick up some of the conversation. I'm like, oh, they're talking about this thing. Like, thank you. But I'm like, what's actually happening?
But you know what's funny? I can actually pick up Spanish. Like, I can pick up Spanish relatively perfectly.
It's like French in that way.
Oh,
like,
I can't pick up French at all.
Like, if you know French, you'll be able to kind of get Italian and Spanish, but it doesn't really work the other way, because French has all of the kind of modifications that I had a friend growing up, I think I mentioned this at the beginning, that I also took some Spanish, but then I had a friend growing up that was Brazilian, and they spoke Portuguese, and I was like, fuck if I know. You know what I mean? Like, I'm already so removed, but it is, like, but that, I love the way that you put it, that it is a radical act to have the language, even, mm-hmm. which is completely true, because it is that, so, I want to ask, like, you know, being in the room where this is happening, like, having that experience shown and part of the space, like, how does that feel?
Ooh. I don't know if I have any feelings about it yet. Just because
we're still in the process.
Yeah.
There's been some hiccups a little bit that we've been just trying to, you know.
But I think personally, I'd be really interested to see from an audience perspective what that would be like to be in that room. Just because it's been my experience, particularly when we've utilized Portuguese in my like I've written in Portuguese and English for a lot of plays in Iowa, and 9 times out of 10, the comment that I would get was like, as soon as Portuguese was used, I dropped out. And I was like, ah, oh, come on. It's such a performative language. It's so, it's such a sing-song. Yeah. It's like musical language.
Yeah.
That's really what it is. Like, I remember writing another play where, like, almost 45% of it was in Portuguese. And, like, sadly, half of it were, like, older white gay audience. That's not them. Older white audiences were just, like, dropped out. Or we're like, I can't do this, I can't register the play. It was just like, at some point, I had to realize, it was like, the problem isn't necessarily me, the problem is
the audience.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And we are also approaching, I mean, we're also approaching a kind of, I would hope, it's also a little bit subversive in a sense, considering the political environment we are, where people want to, you know, remain enclavey and remaining their own things. It's like, no, this is a globalist society. We are all super interconnected. So the fact that we can engage, like, in, you know, we can engage with others in Elven, mm-hmm. can equally translate into an action. I know. I love that. I love that quote, though. Yeah. But it's so powerful to be able to attempt to understand another culture, let alone another language. And though you may not necessarily get every single word, you can at least get the cadence and you can get the performance of it. Understand, oh, this must be something bad. Or at least be able to, like, lean in and listen, as opposed to lean out and turn the other way, which is a common trope with audiences, which is why I'm really, really happy, not just in terms of Portuguese, although it's, you know, rare in terms of the Latinx theater, that we are getting more plays that are playing with willing to play with language on stage and make audiences willingly uncomfortable, or at least sort of shift them to train them to train their ears to be a little more attuned to more than just text, but subtext, context, and even sort of a liminal text that is performative and tonal, which I think is incredibly powerful. I mean, I think about that in, like, karaoke all the time. If I'm trying to perform someone else's words, how else am I going to perform them differently as if it were another language?
And I hope audiences do lean into it just because of the rhythmic sound that is Portuguese, as well as gaming and soccer.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that'll totally, like, oh, wait, I'm even more engaged because of all these different, again, the layers that are laid out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a whole world of slang and lexicon that we utilize now that is you could craft its own language upon that. And how is that any different about understanding another different language that, oh, I don't know, it just uses more nasals? Like, it's I think we do as humans an incredible disservice in an ability to empathize with another person's culture purely on the basis of language alone. I think it's a incredible disservice, and I'm hoping that in another way this play is a matter of education and empathy for another culture that you may not necessarily understand, but the emotional undertones of it are incredibly present.
Yeah.
I actually had a similar question, but not the same kind of question. I'm wondering how y'all feel about doing this play site-specifically and immersively. Has that changed your perspective at all? Or what are you... Because that's our thing, the NWAC thing.
For me, it just adds, again, another layer to the story, and also just... Yeah.
Well, I think about the fact that when I found out that it was on top of a flower shop, it's like, oh, I get to use more florals this time. The idea, well, there's like the line, like, I can't run a botanica or a business.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that floral spaces have this sort of magic associated with them and sort of a curative aspect of it, like a salve. So I kept thinking about, like, how do we color the space with plants? How do we utilize plants and water and all these earthy aspects and smell to really engage with this play a little bit more? And the fact that, like, think about funerals. Funerals are also associated with flowers. The fact that we, you know, we talk about breathing. There's also, like, a whole series of breathing and panic attacks and, you know, cadence, and that all is sort of a respiratory thing. So I think after seeing the space, I was able to come back to the play and change it again to accommodate that sort of spatial spirituality of what that play was. So I think it's really cool. I like the idea of, like, an audience, like, yeah, they're gonna chill out for, like, a hot minute in that floral shop, I don't know, buy some flowers or something, and maybe come back out based on this play to have a sort of different reaction or corporeal response to the flower shop or to anything based on what they've seen upstairs into the downstairs of their lives.
Yeah, we're doing the show at Christy Weber's garden and landscaping place, which is on Chicago and California. Public transit goes there, and it's actually...
Yes, it does.
It's, so it's an amazing space, and they actually have a pig.
Francis!
A cute little pig, like, in their place.
But he's growing now.
Yeah, and so I kind of think of him as, like, our mascot a little bit. But the show takes place on the second floor. Like, they have, like, a loft area that basically feels like an apartment, and it's perfect for the show.
I gotta ask you, so at this point, do you have any tips for how to talk a flower shop into letting you do a performance there?
Negotiation.
Yeah.
Patience.
Yeah.
I was actually checking out the space for a film shoot that I was looking for a space for a film thing that fell through. And then it just kept coming into my mind, and we wanted to do a show in a location that we've never done a show before. We've never done a show like that far south or west, and just... Yeah, and they're so kind. The people that work there are really awesome. They're allowing us to be in there on the weekends to rehearse, so we actually get to rehearse in the space before tech, which is really helpful for rewrites and just the actors understanding
the space.
It's relationship building. It's like it's a whole. I mean, in the rehearsal room, but also in the community is so fascinating to me. Way.
Yeah. It's hard. It's actually hard for our company in that way because we move so much and we're in so many different locations that it's hard to find like that audience that sticks with us because people don't like to leave. They don't like to travel. People don't like to travel as much as they think they like to travel. Mm-hmm. But the people that do like are our followers and stick with us and go to the different locations are always so happy and excited to have found a new place that they've never been before. And they sell like local honey and just cute affordable plants, house plants. It's not really, I don't know if I would call it like a flower shop. It's more of a garden.
Yeah, it really is.
A garden. I
mean, they sell mums. and gardenia is another fun stuff. And like little terrariums, which are really, really cool.
Yeah, they got a nice selection of succulents too.
They do have a lovely selection of succulents.
And succulents are real hard to die, are real hard to kill. So like if you're like, I don't have a green thumb, but I want to try something, the succulents.
They're hardy little buggers.
I definitely managed it. Yeah, I definitely did that.
You managed to kill it?
Yeah.
Oh.
I had one right here, and it's so fun. I was like, I'll put it here because like I'll never forget to. But then I just kept looking at it and going like, oh, it's fun. Yeah, no, it's good.
Yeah, you do. You have to water it every like 2 weeks.
Right. So. Yeah. And then like a month went, and I was like, oh yeah, it's fun. I think I did it. I don't know. Yeah,
she's still
right
there.
I must have done it. It's right there.
Okay. Like, well, maybe not everyone.
Yeah. Well, cool. We have a few minutes left. So the last thing we do with all of our guests is a one-minute plug for anything they have upcoming. Sometimes that's very obvious, like letting people know about an upcoming round of performances that are happening at a floral shop, if that was a thing that you were doing. Otherwise, we love hearing any shout-outs to other folks that are doing dope work or any media that you're consuming, self-care or otherwise, music, movies, TV shows, things like that.
Oh my god.
Let's see.
So,
should I talk about the next show we're working on?
Yeah, so Hannah and I are tag teaming again. We have another show going up at Pride Films and Plays called Desiring a Tinier House, which is a two-hander about two men who find each other in a parking lot and get into a relationship and take on the downfall of human civilization as we know it. In a tiny house.
Very, very timely.
So, yeah. So, that goes up during Gay Pride Month in June at the Buena over at Pride Films and Plays on North Broadway. I'm currently dramaturging myself on a show called Bell's Palsy and Other American Side Effects, written by Debbie Baños at 16th Street Theater, which is currently getting developed and will have a public showing in April. I'm really excited about that play. It's a one-woman show. It's so beautiful. I've cried 3 times, and I was just reading the script. So it's a really great, great thing. I really love it. People should definitely go out and see it out in Berwyn. It's pretty awesome. What else you got going on, Hannah?
Oh, yeah. I'm about to actually travel for a new play festival in Arizona to be a dramaturg on a play for young audiences. So nice. That's about to happen.
Southwest.
Yeah, I'm excited to actually see the sun for a minute. So it'll be nice.
I guess I should also say that I'm also like, I'm also working on like a one-man musical that I'm performing in about unrequited love
with
as
Selena?
Mental illness, huh?
With Selena?
No, sadly, but I've written all my own music. So, and that's gonna be with Prop Magic Productions over at the Prop Theater. Eventually, and then I'm working on another play that will hopefully have a reading in the summer or into early fall about Mega Man X, the video game, queer transitioning, and queer loneliness and belonging, and apparently it's going to become a 3-act play. So, and that's with Broken Nose Theater.
Cool.
As a part of their development process. So lots of fun stuff.
Oh, wait, I do have one more plug,
go
too,
for
real
it.
Quick.
Yes, please do.
So, I got so many, so go ahead.
So I'm also doing some data analysis at Victory Gardens Theater for all of their social justice public programs, so all of their events that they've got going on. Currently, Pipeline is about to open.
Yes.
I've only read the script, and I'm so excited to get in to actually see Final Dress. Go see this play. And come and talk about this play, and also talk to me about this play, because I want to know your thoughts on it. So, Pipeline at VG.
And go listen to Brava, which is the podcast show about Make Believe, by Nancy Garcia Loza. It is amazing, and so necessary and important, too.
Thank you for bringing that back.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can listen to it on Spotify.
Yes.
Nice.
So... tickets are now currently available for The Soccer Player in the Closet at nothingwithoutacompany.org, and they're super affordable, and we also pay our artists, so we really appreciate people paying for tickets. And then we also do some free or pay what you can self-care stuff with Nothing Without a Company. So Burger Park, which is on Sheridan and Granville, is our home, and we have yoga on Saturday mornings at 10:30 for free or pay what you can, and then same thing with Zumba on Mondays at 7, and I attend all of those, or both of those, because, you know, hashtag self-care, it's important. Then we also have a 24-hour play festival coming up on May 4th, and we're going to have all the writers write in the line, "May the 4th be with you." That'll be fun. That'll be in Uptown. And then we have our super queer gala coming up that is called Wonderball, and everyone, we're requesting that everyone wear something that makes them feel like their inner superhero.
Nice.
That's gonna be super fun at Theater Works on Belmont, and that's June 1st. You can't get your tickets yet, but you'll be able to get them at some point soon. And then we've got a prequel to Not One Ba Two called Pakalolo Suite.
Right,
written
cool.
by Hannah, nice. Which will also be in Hawaiian Pidgin English coming up in September. So,
Please come back for all of these things.
For sure.
This was really, really fantastic. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you all so much for listening as well. If you want to keep up with what we're up to, there are a lot of ways you can do that. The first is to head over to scopymag.com. That's our website. We post all of our podcast episodes and articles there. You can also find us on social media. On Facebook, we have a Facebook page called Scopy Magazine. We also have a Facebook group that we love and adore called Sounding Board. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Tumblr under Scopy Mag, and you can find the podcast, the one you're listening to right now, Scopy Radio, and most podcast places, including Google Play, iTunes Podcasts, and Radio Public. Also, I'm going to butcher this part, but I'm going to do it anyway. One of the things that you can do to support us is subscribe, and there are a lot of ways that you can do that. The first I'm going to mention, and the most important, is to head over to our subscribe page and put in your email address. If you do that, you'll get emails every time that we post something on the website, which is the most... assured way that you'll be able to keep up with everything that we're doing. It'd be a lot of emails, but there are a lot of people that love them, so check it out. Otherwise, you can subscribe to us on any platform that you can to make sure to keep up with as much of their content. Otherwise, you can also support us financially. We have individual donation levels that come with different pieces to them. We have tote bags and all that kind of, you know, NPR type shit. We also have advertisement spots. If you're interested in that, we have spots on the website and we have spots on the podcast. We'd love to tell people about your local business, or just if you've got something fun to say. So please feel free to reach out to us at scopymag@gmail.com. So give a little, give a lot, and if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share, and go out and make something.